Hello and welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Moira McLean, back in the host chair, and joining me tonight is Helena, aka No Justice MTG. Hey Helena, hello.
It's good to be here, as always, looking forward to the show.
Coming up later tonight, we talk to an expert on artificial intelligence about the news that the Israeli military have been using that technology to target Palestinians. Suella Braverman has gone on her own diplomatic mission to Israel to say that the UK government aren't supporting Israel enough. And a former Tory... He didn't change it. Okay. Well, I'll just do now. And a former Tory MP is facing the threat of expulsion for calling out his party's support for Israel. Let's go to our first story. In the wake of 7 humanitarian workers, including 3 British citizens, killed by Israeli missiles, the UK government is coming under increasing pressure to stop selling weapons to Israel. 3 former Supreme Court judges, as well as 600 other legal experts, have written to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, warning him that continuing to arm Israel breaches international law. The letter is 17 pages long and also amounts to a formal legal opinion, one I think Sunak probably wishes he hadn't asked for. In it, the lawyers and the judges say this. While we welcome the increasingly robust calls by your government for a cessation of fighting and the unobstructed entry to Gaza of humanitarian assistance, simultaneously to continue, to take 2 striking examples, the sale of weapons and weapons systems to Israel and to maintain threats of suspending UK aid to UNRWA falls significantly short of your government's obligations under international law. One of the 3 former Supreme Court judges who signed that letter is Lord Sumpton, and he gave his reasons to Radio 4's Today programme.
The most important point is that Article 1 of the Genocide Convention requires states to do what they can to prevent genocide. Now, it hasn't yet been determined whether what the Israelis are doing is genocide. The ICJ, International Court of Justice, is considering that issue. But they have already ruled that there is a plausible case that that is what is going on in Gaza. And it seems to me that if you have a duty, as we do, in international law to prevent genocide, and there is a plausible case that that is what is happening, you should do what you can to obstruct it.
At this stage, not wait for a final ruling which could be years to come?
Well, the deaths and the indiscriminate killing, these things are happening now.
Another signatory to the letter is Guy Goodwin-Gill, Professor of International Refugee Law at Oxford University. He appeared on Al Jazeera and he was asked about the risks to the UK of continuing to sell arms to Israel.
Could the UK's support then to Israel make the UK itself complicit in this genocide?
Yes, it could do. If it doesn't cancel arms sales, for example, it risks being complicit in the act of genocide. There's a serious risk of genocide, as the International Court of Justice has found. And if the UK, with that knowledge in mind, carries on exporting arms to Israel, then there's a risk that those arms will be used in the conduct of aggressive activities by Israel and in the conduct of genocide. It's the risk that's important. And the risk must be factored into account, taken into account now, and arms sales must cease.
Direct arms sales, however, to Israel from the UK, they're pretty small compared to the US. So if the UK were to take this decision to stop selling arms sales, do you think it would be anything more than symbolic?
I do think it would be more than symbolic. I think it would be send a clear message to other states as well that this is something that needs to be done and should be done if states wish to not to be found complicit in the act of genocide. I think it is going to be more than symbolic. It's going to be a very important lever for other states to take into account when pressing on the United States, amongst others, to change their policy.
Also adding his voice to criticisms of the UK government's policy on arms sales to Israel is the brother of one of the British men killed in Gaza. 33-year-old James Henderson was a security consultant for the World Central Kitchen. His brother told The Times this. Accountability is the only hope of justice I have. I don't believe our government will hold the correct people to account, but I guarantee our government will sell weapons to Israel, which may in turn be used to kill our fellow citizens. It's hard to comprehend that. I feel this is an inexcusable behaviour to kill my brother and his colleagues on a humanitarian mission. Our thoughts are with the suffering people who have been deprived of basic humanitarian needs, It's unacceptable for our world leaders to ignore this gross miscarriage of justice. Pressure on the government is also coming from government workers. The iNewspaper reports this. Civil servants in the Department for Business and Trade are threatening legal action against the government over Israel arms exports. They fear that individual civil servants may be held liable for supporting breaches of international humanitarian law. And the Civil Servants Union, PCS, has refused to rule out industrial action if a legal challenge fails. Now, as pressure mounts, there are some signs that it may be beginning to work. We haven't been able to find any other sources for this yet, but Israel's Channel 13 News has reported that Rishi Sunak has issued a stark warning to Benjamin Netanyahu, describing a conversation between the men as difficult and tense. Channel 13 reports that Sunak told Netanyahu this. "The harm to aid workers is intolerable. I understand that your policy is to allow humanitarian aid passage as needed, but in reality, it simply isn't happening. Britain supports the elimination of Hamas, but not at the cost of a humanitarian catastrophe. Without an immediate increase in humanitarian aid, Britain will have to declare Israel as violating international humanitarian law. This is not good for us and not good for you." Now, I presume it would not be good for the UK government to declare the person they've and the country they've supported unequivocally has actually been breaking international humanitarian law. Now, according to Channel 13, Sunak also asked that Britain be allowed to assess the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Netanyahu reportedly assured Sunak that aid would increase in the coming days, as he has continually, but refused to allow access to the prisoners. And now it seems unlikely that Sunak would make the threat to Israel unless he had legal advice backing it up. But if he does already have legal advice, such as the advice of, you know, government lawyers that may have secretly been reported before, should he not have acted on that advice before British citizens, as well as other humanitarian aid workers, were killed, not to mention potentially thousands of Palestinians, depending on when he received that advice? The report from Channel 13 has, of course, not been confirmed by Downing Street. And officially, the government's position hasn't changed. And some members of cabinet do not want to talk about it. This was Foreign Secretary David Cameron on the BBC's Ukraine Cast podcast, recorded after the killing of the aid workers in Gaza.
"We know you have to go. I also have a few quick questions on Israel and Gaza.
Ukraine Cast. I know. So I'm doing that later. So okay. I'm afraid I might, you know, I'm afraid that's, yeah, we're out of time.
That's what I was going to say. Do we have time for anything
else? No, I've got to do a pool later.
That's fine. Will you take any question just quickly on Israel?
No.
Okay. Thank you then. Pleasure. Foreign Secretary.
Only one occupation question at a time. On the other side of the political aisle, Sky News asked Labour's Jonathan Reynolds about arms sales to Israel.
"Should we be pausing sending arms to Israel?"
"Good morning, yes, from Derby. So the government should publish, Kay, the legal advice. So there is a very clear legal regime in the United Kingdom about arms exports where there is any danger of anything exported from the United Kingdom being involved in a serious breach of humanitarian law, then it cannot be exported. So if that threshold has been met, there should be no arms sales to Israel of anything that could be involved in that. And of course, the government will have had information on this. We believe the exceptional step of publishing that is the right response to the concerns that we have seen. And as I say, if that threshold has been met, the law of the UK should be followed and things should not be exported across that threshold."
"Well, let me put it this way, Mr. Reynolds, if I may. Should the arms licences to Israel at least be suspended until the investigation into the killing of the British aid workers is concluded?"
"Well, the regime is a robust one as it stands. The point would not be about suspending something. If anything is exported from the UK that could be at risk of being involved in a breach of humanitarian law, then it must not be exported. So I believe that the right thing to do is to apply that regime, and we need to see the advice from the government has received. There have been a lot of rumours as to what that would be. Publishing that transparently is the right step. And as I say, there's no question as to what happens if that threshold has been met. Those goods cannot be exported."
We've said this before, but this is not a genuine demand that the government publish its legal advice. The UK government almost never makes its legal advice public, and Labour knows this only too well, having refused to publish its legal advice over the Iraq war until 2010, and only then because a court forced it to. This is really a stalling device, one that makes it look like Labour is taking a firm position when actually it's taking its favourite position, which is no position at all. With pressure mounting on the government to cease arms exports to Israel, we should point out that demands on that front could change quickly, because Israel is currently on high alert, anticipating an attack from Hezbollah or Iran in retaliation for the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus. All IDF reservists have reportedly been called up, military leave has been cancelled, and GPS jamming systems deployed. And you can bet that if that attack happens, a lot of this discourse and pressure around banning arms sales to Israel will evaporate. Helena, are we actually about to see the UK government ban arms exports to Israel?
I can't really say for sure whether or not we are going to see it, but I think there's a couple of points worth raising around the situation, which is, first of all, why were we arming them in the first place? I know this seems like a very basic question to be asking here, but let's be real. Let's look at the thing in the round, i.e. this is a state that it is an apartheid state, has been called by many different humanitarian organizations. It's continuing to increase the illegal settlement, the internationally illegal settlements within the West Bank. Again, this military is the one who enforces the occupation, again, with our arms that we sell them. And we know that they've been doing this illegally because we are now actually doing sanctions on Israeli settlements in the wake of October the 7th, although the status of these settlements hasn't changed between what it was before October the 7th and what it was afterwards in terms of the level of its illegality. And we are still backing up, both militarily and diplomatically, an apartheid state that violates international law. And why should we still be selling any arms to these people, even if we take anything that's happened over the last 6 months not into account at this point? On top of that, we didn't really, outside of us here on the left, we didn't really have this discussion over whether or not we should be supplying arms to Israel whilst they were, as has been stated in the many news segments that we just listened to, on trial for genocide at the International Court with huge amounts of evidence as for the intent to cause a genocide in Gaza. And we've been describing it as a genocidal war for the last however many months on this channel. And even that hasn't been enough impetus for a broader discussion on why indeed we have been selling arms to Israel, you know, for years and years in this country. And then also some Europeans have been killed, including some British citizens. Oh, well, now we're going to speak about it. We're going to talk about the 32,000 dead Palestinian civilians in Gaza, although there are at least some number of those who are civilians, a majority of those civilians in Gaza that have been killed by the Israeli military in their genocidal war. Though that is completely swept under the rug in terms of the discussion on this. But as soon as some British citizens have been killed, okay, now we can have this discussion. Just shows you the selective basis in which we get a discussion over our own complicity in what is going on within the Israel-Palestine conflict, the genocidal war against the Palestinians in Gaza. Again, worth pointing out, just like everything in terms of government policy with regards to this, we follow the Washington line. They indeed are continuing to aid and abet Israel in terms of supplying them with military hardware and financing to engage in the genocidal war against the Palestinians. And on top of that, what has also been very clear across every single discussion we've had over this conflict is that the supermajority of public opinion is against the government's line. Yet again, there was another poll out today that showed a supermajority support in this country amongst the population for revoking arms licenses to the state of Israel. And yet, where are our politicians? They don't even listen to us. We have no individual, so we have no independent foreign policy in this country. It just gets set by what the Washington consensus is, what the pro-Western consensus is on this issue more broadly. Although notwithstanding, we still see plenty of attempts by our media and by our people, by our political agitators, to try and manufacture consent away from this. We just saw Dan Hodges today describing the desire for an arms embargo in Israel as being student politics. I guess all of those legal experts that we've been listening to throughout this segment are just people who don't know what they're talking about, or just people also engaging student politics, I guess. But I do hope we'll see some kind of restrictions in arms sales to Israel. But as you say, the threat of a broader escalating conflict in the region makes that probably unlikely in my mind.
Now, compared to the US, Britain doesn't export a lot of weapons or weapons parts to Israel. According to Defence Secretary Grant Shapps, the total export value of British parts was valued at around £42 million a year. But that doesn't mean our exports aren't causing a huge amount of destruction in Gaza. The founder of World Central Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres, has spoken to CBS News about Israel's killing of 7 aid workers employed by his organisation.
17 members between the specialty security people we have three British individuals and three international crew plus one Palestinian, that they were targeted systematically, car by car. And this happened over more than 1.5, 1.8 kilometers. So this was not just a bad luck situation where, oops, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place or no. This was over 1.5, 1.8 kilometers with a very defined humanitarian convoy that had signs in the top, in the roof, a very colorful logo that we are obviously very proud of, but that's very clear who we are and what we do. But what I know is that we were targeted deliberately, nonstop, until everybody was dead in this convoy. That cannot be the role of an army. That cannot be the role of an army that has hundreds of drones above Gaza in any single moment. Humanitarians and civilians should never be paying the consequences of war. This is a basic principle of humanity. At the time, this looks like it's not a war against terrorism anymore. Seems this is a war against humanity itself.
British-made weapon parts are playing a key role in that war against humanity itself. In that clip, Andreas mentions hundreds of drones above Gaza. Well, many of those drones will be these. This is the Hermes 450 drone designed by Israeli arms company Elbit Systems. At a length of just over 6 meters and weighing 180 kilograms, the drones can be equipped with a variety of missiles and still travel at speeds of more than 100 miles an hour. Almost completely silent in flight, they can reach altitudes of up to 18,000 feet, making them all but invisible from the ground. Its weapon systems are controlled remotely from an operations room, potentially hundreds of miles away, meaning that a soldier can kill people in targeted strikes without being anywhere near them. That's exactly what happened on Monday night when the world's central kitchen workers were killed in three separate targeted strikes on three different vehicles over the span of several minutes. And the drone involved in that atrocity has been reported as a Hermes 450 by the Times, Haaretz, and many other outlets. According to export licenses, those Israeli Hermes 450 drones may be powered by engines made in the UK by UAV Engines, a company based in Staffordshire. Its parent company is Elbit Systems, the manufacturers of the Hermes drones. Until just a few years ago, UAV Systems was exporting components to Israel, but the company denied they were being used by Israeli drones, saying they were for onward export to third countries only. But in 2009, a senior official with the export section of the government's Department for Business said this could not be confirmed, as no officials checked what happened to them once they left the country. Addressing the claims that UK parts might have been used in the drone that killed the aid workers, a spokesperson for Elbit told the Daily Mail that, quote, Elbit Systems UK subsidiaries and joint ventures, including UAV Engines Limited and UTAX, are not involved in the Hermes 450 programme. That may be true today, but that doesn't mean they weren't involved in the past. And it isn't It isn't an ultimate denial that UAV's engine parts are not involved in the drones flying over Gaza today. Let's go on to our next related story. As the UK government faces mounting pressure to suspend the arms trade with Israel, one politician has embarked on a special diplomatic mission. Yes, the MP for Fareham, Suella Braverman, dispatched herself to Israel to lobby the UK to increase its support for the country. Braverman formerly served as Home Secretary, but now is just a backbench MP with no cabinet or ministerial position. But that hasn't stopped her from holding talks with senior Israeli politicians and military figures. In a post on X, Braverman wrote this. Today, I met with senior military and political figures in Israel to discuss the war in Gaza and the tragic strike on the aid convoy. My thoughts and prayers go out to the family and friends of those killed. This was a terrible mistake for which Israel has rightly apologised. Well, so long as they've apologised. She also took the time to embark on a little media tour. The backbench Prime Minister spoke to BBC Radio 4 from Israel, insisting that the country was following the rules of war in Gaza and that she had seen the proof. Here's what she told the Today programme when they asked if Israel was breaching international humanitarian law.
the suggestion itself is absurd and frankly an insult to Israel, who's been going above and beyond the necessary requirements to ensure that civilian casualties are limited, to ensure that aid is received onto the Gaza Strip and distributed. I've seen evidence myself in terms of very up-to-date photographic evidence of plentiful food packages and trucks of food, water and medicines getting to the people of Gaza.
Wow. So long as Suella Braverman, the woman who wanted to break international law by shipping people to Rwanda, doesn't think that Israel is breaking international law, I'm sure it's all okay. Ignore the other legal experts, witness testimony, and the International Court of Justice agreeing to hear a case that accuses Israel of committing genocide. Suella Braverman, MP for Fareham, says it's fine. Matter of fact, let's ignore the Israeli doctors who say that the law is being broken. This is a Haaretz story published today, citing a doctor working at an Israeli detention centre holding Palestinians detained from Gaza. The doctor told Haaretz that conditions for the inmates likely violated international law. The article reads, "Just this week, two prisoners had their legs amputated due to handcuff injuries, which unfortunately is a routine event," the physician said in the letter. He said inmates are fed through straws, defecate in diapers, and are held in constant restraints which violate medical ethics and the law. The doctor told reporters he has voiced his concerns in a letter sent to Israel's defense minister, health minister, and attorney general. The letter opens like this. "From the first days of the medical facility's operation until today, I have faced serious ethical dilemmas. More than that, I'm writing this letter to warn you that the facility's operations do not comply with a single section among those dealing with health in the incarceration of the unlawful combatants law. For their part, the IDF said they operated according to the law and within the framework when it comes to the treatment of detainees. Every procedure is documented and monitored and is done with extreme care for human dignity of the detainees in accordance with the principles of Israeli and international law. We just make people shit in diapers. That's dignity. Plus, Suella Braverman says everything is hunky-dory, so it's got to be fine. While on her Israel jaunt, she also took the time to give a long, long interview to The Telegraph, in which she accused the US and the UK of, quote, backsliding when it comes to Israel. Braverman criticised the UN Security Council resolution passed last month, which called for a ceasefire in Gaza, and said she was concerned that a, quote, pro-Palestine Foreign Office establishment view was influencing government policy. So pro-Palestine that the funding to a key aid organisation in Gaza remains suspended after unfounded Israeli allegations that UNRWA staff were linked to the October 7th attacks. But the UK has yet to suspend arms sales to Israel despite the 32,000 recorded Palestinian dead, the destroyed territory, or extensive evidence that humanitarian workers, including British citizens, have been deliberately targeted and killed by the country. Seems extremely pro-Palestine. Braverman didn't stop there, though. She also appeared to discuss specific Israeli military operations. This is a tweet from Israel's representative to the UN. "It was a pleasure to meet with UK MP Suella Braverman, a true friend of Israel. I expressed my gratitude for her consistent and unwavering support and discussed Israel's determination to enter Rafah, defeat Hamas, and return all our hostages." Now, he's referring to the Rafah offensive that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has officially registered his, quote, concern about. This is what Sunak said regarding the threatened Israeli Rafah operation in February. "We're deeply concerned about reports about a military operation in Rafah, given it's important to a provision. So what we've been calling for is an immediate pause in hostilities so we can get more aid in and hostages out, and then build the conditions for a sustainable ceasefire that remains the focus of all our diplomatic efforts." Foreign Secretary David Cameron also said last month that the fighting in Gaza must stop, and he added, "That's what we need to happen rather than a Rafah offensive." Braverman's, quote, private mission to Israel was funded by the National Jewish Assembly, an organisation which counts, quote, supporting Israel as one of its three key missions. Her visit, even if approved by Rishi Sunak, which it probably was, could well further add to his reputation as an increasingly weak prime minister. Because it's one thing to say, yes, you can go to Israel on this little trip, but it's another thing to let a backbencher post leadership-esque photo shoots and discuss official military strategy with high-level politicians, especially when you're fighting fire from the fact that three British citizens were just killed at the hands of that government. Priti Patel in 2017 had to resign from her role in the Foreign Office for holding undisclosed meetings with Israeli officials. But will Sunak sanction Suella, or will she continue to direct her own one-woman foreign policy from the back of the Commons? Helena, what is Braverman thinking?
So I think that a lot of people's kind of instant reaction to this would be, oh, look at a pro-Israeli lobbyist trying to influence British policy. And I think obviously there's plenty of that going around here. But actually, I think that's not what's going on in this specific instance. The specific instance that we're seeing here is Suella Braverman's own personal career goals and personal motivations. That's what she's very specifically doing here. You mentioned, of course, Rishi Sunak personally being a very, very weak Prime Minister. It took so many different kind of violations and underminings from Suella Braverman when she was on the front bench for actually to get removed from the front bench, because of course she has her own personal leadership ambitions. She knows that essentially a lot of what Sunak is kind of running on has kind of moved away from the kind of positions that she was trying to cater to in her role as Home Secretary, to replace by somebody more quote unquote sensible in the terms of and James Cleverly in a replacement position as Home Secretary. And she explicitly tries to court the votes of a lot of people on the very kind of right wing of the UK politics at the moment. It's clear that she wants a kind of internal challenge. She knows that Rishi Sunak's future political career is dead in the water when it comes to what's happening at the next election, where the Conservative Party is almost certainly going to get absolutely annihilated at the election. And she is trying to position herself broadly within the party to try and fight for the right wing of the Conservative membership, but also be there as somebody who can then run on the fact that, well, there weren't enough tough lines taken on all of these different kind of issues within the discourse around how right-wing Sunak is or is not in terms of his policy and foreign policy prospectus, as well as, of course, influencing David Cameron as somebody seen as being a kind of more moderate figure who she can run against and say, well, actually, you lost the election because you weren't pro-Israel enough. You lost it because you allowed there to be hate marches on our streets. And that's clearly what she is taking the Israel-Palestine issue as her kind of central way of signalling to the far right just who she supports and just where she thinks the kind of direction of travel of discourse in this country is going to go. Like, for example, when she is signalling about like the hate marches and when she was signalling to the far right to try and get them to turn up on the Saturday before Remembrance Sunday, when there was this sad Palestine protest where they went and essentially had this kind of brawl outside the cenotaph. It's because she is following along from this kind of discourse that you got from, remember Isaac Herzog kind of talking about Israel as being the bulwark against the East, the bulwark against like the UK and European countries being next when it comes to the kind of Islamic influence, whatever it might be. And it's clear that she also buys into that with all of the discourse she's had from the American Enterprise Institute lecture where she criticized multiculturalism. It's very clear to me that her kind of explicitly pro-Western foreign policy, her explicitly kind of anti-Islamic narrative that I've seen so far is going to be where she's going to try and take her own personal campaign for the Conservative leadership after the next election. And it's very dangerous rhetoric, of course, as we've seen, given what she said about kind of Rwanda, what she said about Palestine. But to try and make this just about what she's trying to do with regards to this conflict specifically, I think it's far more Machiavellian and kind of far more personal in trying to undermine Rishi Sunak, because she knows full well that Rishi Sunak can't like remove the whip, even though we'll come to that later, because she is such a kind of firebrand person in Conservative politics that it would be kind of breaking that kind of trust of his own membership if he were to take such a kind of factional expulsion from the Conservative parliamentary party on an issue such as this. So she knows she has free rein and she will exercise it thusly.
Let's go on to our next story. Israel has one of the most technologically advanced militaries in the world. And in the past, the country's use of that murderous technology was guided by human judgment. Not necessarily good judgment or moral judgment, but human judgment nonetheless. But it has now been revealed that since October 7th, Israel has been letting machines decide who lives and who dies in Gaza. And the consequences of exchanging moral complexity for robotic simplicity have been even more deadly. Lavender is the ironic name of the AI machine that has been directing Israel's bombing spree in Gaza. This is coming from 972 magazine in a joint investigation with Local Call. And they say algorithms have marked tens of thousands of Palestinians for assassination with little human oversight and a permissive policy when it comes to collateral casualties. The investigation is based on military documents and the testimony of six intelligence sources who have served in the army during Israel's assault on Gaza. According to the report, the AI machine is used to identify potential members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad before putting them on a kill list. It does this by making use of the massive Israeli surveillance system already in place in Gaza. This slide is from an IDF intelligence lecture given at Tel Aviv University last year. The system is fed information about people already identified as Hamas members, the inner circle, and extracts certain common features. These features are then used to identify other suspects, the outer circle, by assessing which features they have in common with the original group. Individuals assign numbers, which represent the degree to which those features are present. For those of you aware with the about the workings of the Met Police's gangs matrix, this will sound quite familiar. These features include, among other things, being in a WhatsApp group with a known militant, changing mobile phone every few months, and changing addresses frequently. And clearly, those are the kind of features that lots of people with no real connection to Hamas could share. Lavender then uses that information to rate Palestinians on how similar they are to Hamas fighters. That produces a rank, and those who score above a certain threshold are targeted for assassination. But the threshold appears to be incredibly arbitrary. One senior intelligence source told 972 this. In a day without targets, whose feature rating was sufficient to authorize a strike, we attacked at a lower threshold. We were constantly being pressured. Bring us more targets. They really shouted at us. We finished killing our targets very quickly. The source also said this. At its peak, the system managed to generate 37,000 people as potential human targets. But the numbers changed all the time because it depends on where you set the bar of what Hamas operative is. There were times when a Hamas operative was defined more broadly, and then the machine started bringing us all kinds of civil defense personnel, police officers, on whom it would be a shame to waste bombs. They help the Hamas governments, but they don't really endanger soldiers. God, that line. It would be a shame to waste bombs. Also, remember, this is a military that is directed by a government who have said everyone in Gaza can be Hamas operative. That is the information they are feeding to this AI machine. These are the algorithms. Algorithms are programmed by humans. They're not independent. They are completely controlled by our own biases, by our own perceptions. And that's what's being fed into Lavender. Now, despite knowing that Lavender returned a wrong result, even by, you know, the standards of what the IDF consider a Hamas operative, around 10% of the time, 972 reports that the IDF had little interest in using human resources to verify its targets. The same senior intelligence source said this. A human being had to verify the target for just a few seconds. At first, we did checks to ensure that the machine didn't get confused. But at some point, we relied on the automatic system, and we only checked that the target was a man. That was enough. It doesn't take a long time to tell if someone has a male or female voice. I would invest 20 seconds for each target at this stage and do dozens of them every day. I had zero added value as a human apart from being a stamp of approval. It saved a lot of time. If the operative came up in the automated mechanism and I checked it, he was a man, there would be permission to bomb him, subject to an examination of collateral damage. One of the most obvious flaws of a system like this, beyond the fact it is completely disgusting and murderous, is that it also completely misunderstands the nature of a resistance force embedded in society. A second source told 972 this. How close does a person have to be to Hamas to be considered by an AI machine to be affiliated with the organization? It's a vague boundary. Is a person who doesn't receive a salary from Hamas but helps them with all sorts of things a Hamas operative? Is someone who was in Hamas in the past but no longer there today a Hamas operative? Each of these features, characteristics that a machine would flag as suspicious, is inaccurate. I mean, again, this is a military that has literally justified going into a hospital and shooting healthcare workers because they might be Hamas as something that's totally fine. And now they're using these machines to make killing decisions. It also creates a further mechanistic dehumanizing attitude amongst the military, and it outsources moral responsibility to a system that has no morality, no guilt, and no regret. A source who used Lavender told 972 this. There was no zero error policy. Mistakes were treated statistically because of the scope and magnitude. The protocol was that even if you don't know for sure that the machine is right, you know that statistically, it's fine. So you go for it. There appears to be an approach to killing innocents that was seen as a feature of this software and not a bug. And this is the senior intelligence source again. It has proven itself. There's something about the statistical approach that sets a certain norm and standard. There's been an illogical amount of bombings in this operation. This is unparalleled in my memory. And I have much more trust in a statistical mechanism than a soldier who lost a friend 2 days ago. Everyone there, including me, lost people on October 7th. The machine did it coldly, and that made it easier. Once Lavender had identified targets, 972 reports that a second system was used to maximize the chances of killing them. This is where it gets really disgusting, because this system is called Where's Daddy, and it's a tracking software linked to Israel's mass surveillance system inside Gaza. Rather than having to hunt for a marked target throughout Gaza, the IDF links each target to their family home. Then all the IDF have to do is wait. That's because Where's Daddy automatically alerts the IDF when a person put on the kill list by Lavender enters their home, which is then bombed. But who else is likely to be in a family home? Women and children, of course. A source who had been an officer in a target operation room told 972 this. Let's say you calculate there is one Hamas operative plus 10 civilians in the house. Usually these 10 will be women and children. So absurdly, it turns out that most of the people you killed were women and children. So far, over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, and over two-thirds of them have been women and children. If 972's investigation is correct, and Israel is deliberately killing entire families out of convenience, it goes a long way to explaining that grotesque statistic. And according to IDF sources, Israel exercised no proportionality in authorizing large numbers of civilian killings. 972's Operation Room source told the magazine this. It's not just that you can kill any person who is a Hamas soldier, which is clearly permitted and legitimate in the terms of international law, but they directly tell you, you're allowed to kill them along with many civilians. Every person who wore a Hamas uniform in the past year or two could be bombed with 20 civilians killed as collateral damage, even without special permission. In practice, the principle of proportionality did not exist. According to 972 sources, American pressure has led the IDF to moderate its attitude to civilian casualties in recent months. And in a statement, the IDF denied much of what was said by 972 sources, writing this. Each target is examined individually, while an individual assessment is made of the military advantage and collateral damage expected from the attack. The IDF does not carry out attacks when collateral damage expected from the attack is excessive in relation to the military advantage. I mean, that's not really a denial, because that is complete subjective. So just go back through that again. Each target is examined individually. Well, all the sources said, yes, we individually, you know, do the box tick, but we weren't really checking it. And they said the IDF does not carry out attacks when collateral damage expected from the attack is excessive in relation to the military advantage. Who's assessing what the military advantage is there? Who is assessing whether it's worth it? Who has raised Gaza to the ground saying that it's worth what happened October 7th? Conclusions. Earlier today, I spoke to Noel Sharkey, Emeritus Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics at the University of Sheffield. I began by asking him whether this is a watershed moment for the use of AI in warfare.
I think it looks like a watershed moment. We've been looking at these systems and how they've been developing for some time, but this is the first time we've actually caught explicit use. I mean, they may have been used before in Syria. There's no way of telling. But this seems to be very clear from the report we've both read that it is the case that it's being used.
What would that mean, though, for future conflicts now that it is open knowledge that this sort of AI is being employed?
It could be a watershed moment in another sense. Maybe we'll see the devastation and harm this has caused and stop it. We've been fighting for a new treaty to stop this at the UN since 2012. Okay, so a long time. And it always seems to be getting somewhere, but then somebody vetoes it every time, so we never get there. But maybe this will push it forward a bit.
You mentioned a treaty that you've been working on since 2012. Who was the we that you're talking about there, and what is that treaty?
In 2012... I got together with a number of other NGOs like Human Rights Watch, Pugwash, Amnesty International, a group of NGOs. I wasn't in an NGO then, and talked to them, and we decided to formulate a campaign. We had a lot of Nobel laureates in the team as well, and we launched a campaign called Stop killer robots. Okay. So Stop Killer Robots campaign began in 2012. In 2013, we had our first UN meeting, and we've had at least two meetings at the UN every year since then. It's become a usual thing at a committee called the CCW, which is there explicitly to prohibit certain weapons, you know, like gas bombs, laser bombs, those kind of things, landmines. And so we wanted a new treaty that would prohibit the use of killer robots, we called them, but autonomous weapon systems. In other words, systems that could target someone and kill them without human intervention.
So you've been involved in this long campaign to stop killer robots, but we are now seeing killer robots being employed in a really devastating military campaign in an occupied territory. How likely is it that the rest of the world will pick up this call instead of simply picking up the tech for themselves?
It's only a few people who are blocking it. United States, Russia, the UK, Australia, and Canada are the main culprits for blocking this. Most of the world is in favour of a prohibition treaty to stop it happening. It's the high-tech nations who don't want to stop it. They think it can be useful. But let me just say one thing is, this is not killer robots being employed here. It's a jagged system that could be, might as well be killer robots, but it's this system called Lavender provides the targets to a human and they check if it's male or female. That's it. And then they pass the targets to another system. I think there's one of them called Where's Daddy? And all that system does, it tracks the target. It tracks the target's home. And when the person comes home, it alerts the military that they've come home. And so then they bomb the house, killing the entire family with the person. They always bomb a house. That's what the system works on, identifying. Now, the bombing strike can be 5 or 6 hours after the person's been spotted going home. So frequently, I should imagine the target isn't even present, but there'd be lots of women and children there who will be killed.
Israel is a hugely militarized society that has a massive reliance on technology. Obviously, the Lavender system that we've heard described is really terrifying, and massive questions about moral conduct there. But what are some of the other pitfalls that happen when you're in this really deep reliance on technology like this?
My concern from the very beginning, I think I wrote my first article on this for The Guardian in 2007, and the same issues remain. My concern then was that it was against the laws of war. What they keep referring to as international humanitarian law, that's what our government here called them, and that the Israelis are not living up to international humanitarian law, because a machine, well, they're very cold for a start, but how well can they discriminate targets? So you're not supposed to kill civilians. That's the first thing. You can kill other combatants or combatants, but you should never kill civilians. And I say never. There's a circumstance in which you can kill civilians. So the law of war I'm talking to is the principle of distinction. The other law, which is equally important, is the principle of proportionality. So any killing that you do must be in direct proportion to military advantage gained. So if you're killing a very lowly foot soldier, it's not, you can't really kill another civilian at the same time. Whereas what the Israelis are doing are killing up to 20. They've got permission to kill up to 20 people for a lowly person, and for a commander, they would be able to kill 100 or so civilians, or as many as it took, essentially. And this is the problem with all of these weapons. Can an automated system be proportionate? No, because nobody even knows what proportionality is. It's a human judgment made by a commander on the ground. There are PhDs written about this in military academies. It's quite ridiculous to think that an AI system could work on a decent law of proportionality. And they're not very good at discriminating either. And even if they could, do we really want to be, you know, a matter of life and death given to a machine? I don't.
Lawyers have also warned that the use of AI might complicate future individual prosecutions on human rights crimes, whether in this war or in future ones. Why might that happen?
A lot of it's got to do with the chain of command and responsibility. Who's responsible when an AI system goes rogue or goes wrong and starts killing? Supposing a system like this could get a, if you, at least there is a human there in this one, but you could have just as easily have it directly connected to drones that went off and did the killing themselves. And that's where it becomes really dangerous, because what if a group of drones just suddenly starts, you know, there's a bug in the system. You've worked with computers. I'm sure everybody watching this obviously has worked with computers, and you know they crash and go wrong a lot. Supposing it goes wrong and they just run off and run rampant and start killing lots of people. Who's responsible for that? It would be so easy to say, oh, the machine went wrong. Sorry, we fixed it now. Rather than take, whereas it could be an evil human who's just doing this. So it's very difficult to work out exactly who is responsible and accountable. Normally in military situations, a commander is responsible for everything. And I've given a lot of talks to the military, talks to, you know, groups of generals and things, and they all quite concerned about the use of these weapons, because they say, I know where the responsibility will end. Probably stop, and that will be with me. So commanders will have to be responsible. But even then, I mean, if you use one of the, people have talked about putting black boxes in them to ensure that, you know, you could look back and see what, who's done what. But it would be very easy to just blow the machine up afterwards and destroy the black box. So that's the kind of, it's about accountability and responsibility. It becomes trickier.
As a longtime campaigner on limiting and regulating the use of autonomous weapon systems, what do you think it would take to get the high-tech nations like the UK to back more regulation?
The problem is that we started off calling for a preemptive ban on the weapons. In other words, before they have been developed, because we found out there were lots and lots of US documents and British documents talking about the development. So we were trying to get in there and get a treaty before they started, because once you've spent billions of dollars on them, how do you get them to stop? And that's been the problem all the time. So what might help is to have examples. For instance, when they were campaigning against landmines, they had pictures of children with their legs blown off, you know, all kinds of nasty injuries. Whereas in our campaign, we're just talking about a future that some people at the beginning, especially Russia, said, why are we bothering talking about this? Because it's never going to happen, although they're in massive development themselves. So maybe when we get more examples and see more, and I don't want that to happen, but maybe that will wake people up. At the moment, we have progressed. We've taken it out of this CCW, which was a swamp where anybody at this UN committee, anybody can veto the whole process. And at the moment, Russia's vetoing every single meeting. So we're not getting very far that way. But what we've managed to do is to get it to the General's Assembly now, with the head of Guterres, the head of the UN. So it's in the General Assembly now, where every nation can vote on it. So we're hopeful there. But I'm not overly hopeful, having spent so long there. To begin with, I was totally optimistic. We got in quickly. We had momentum on our side. Lots of countries were saying, yes, we should ban these immediately. And then, especially the Latin American countries, they were really good. And the African countries, all the people who will be victims of this, essentially. But then suddenly we find out that it just takes three or four nations to block the whole thing. So we've just got to keep fighting them and publicly shame them. That's the thing. Once you've got examples like this example now, we can use that to shame people and say, look what could potentially happen. And these are not even fully autonomous. There's a human there, but the human isn't doing very much.
Let's go to our next story. A former Conservative Foreign Office minister is being investigated by his party after calling for a range of Tory MPs and peers to face repercussions over their support for Israel. Alan Duncan previously served as Minister for International Development and Minister for Europe and the Americas under David Cameron and Theresa May. He has long criticised Israel for breaking international law via the illegal occupation and annexation of Palestinian territory. In 2017, he received an apology from Israel's ambassador to the UK, who was filmed saying he wanted to, quote, take down Duncan because he was, quote, causing a lot of problems. Duncan resigned from government in 2019 when his former boss, Boris Johnson, was elected as Tory party leader. Now Duncan has been placed under investigation for calling out, quote, extremists in his party, who he accused of lobbying the top of UK government in Israel's interests. Duncan made the remarks in an LBC interview this morning, where he also said the UK should immediately stop arms sales to Israel.
We should stop arms sales immediately. I think that anything in support of what is becoming a total catastrophe in Gaza is morally unacceptable. And what we have to accept is not just what they're doing now is wrong, it's what Israel's been doing for years has been wrong, because the Israeli Defense Force does not follow international law. It has been backing and supporting illegal settlers in the West Bank who steal Palestinian land. And it is that land theft, that annexation of Palestine, which is the origin of the problem, which has given rise to the Hamas atrocity and the battles we're seeing. The trouble is, there are a lot of people at the top of our own politics who refuse to condemn settlements and therefore are not supporters of international law. And I think the time has come to flush out those extremists in our own parliamentary politics and around it, some of whom are at the very top of government or have been, and they have never been called to account by journalists in the press to say, well, do you agree with your own party's policy? Do you condemn illegal settlements?
Duncan didn't stop there, though. He named the individuals in the Tory party he believed should be held accountable.
The Conservative Friends of Israel has been doing the bidding of Netanyahu, bypassing all proper processes of government to exercise undue influence at the top of government. So what you have is a lot of people now sitting around Rishi Sunak who are giving him appalling advice. Let's start with the head of CFI, or has been for many years, Lord Pollack. In my view, I think he should be removed from the Lords because he is exercising the interests of another country, not that of the parliament in which he sits. Joined, I have to say, by Lord Pickles. They're the sort of Laurel and Hardy who should be pushed out together. But at the top, I mean, slightly improved by the removal of Robert Jenrick and Suella Braverman, although even today, she is still supporting Israel and the bombing and the annihilation of people in Gaza. And she does not believe that settlements are wrong, nor, I suspect, do Michael Gove, Oliver Dowden, and Priti Patel, by the way, should be reinvestigated for her visit. We still don't know who paid for her trip when she came back and tried to change government policy as a result of going on a secret trip without actually telling her officials or even the local ambassador. And if you pick up Wikipedia and you read the entry for Tom Tugendhat, who is our security minister, it says, and I'll read it out, he condemned the United Nations Security Council for its official criticism of Israel's building settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, that may have been some years ago, but he's never removed that. He's never changed his view. How can you have a security minister in the British government who does not believe in international law when all this is going on? I think he should be sacked.
Nick Ferrari had to then, of course, ask Duncan the classic question about Israel's right to self-defense. Here's how he responded.
Does Israel have a right to defend itself?
It does in certain circumstances, but in the right way. So, by the way, do Palestinians who are bashed up by illegal settlers supported by the Israeli Defense Force have the right to defend themselves because they are the ones who are originally being attacked. But if they try and do that, they're then called terrorists. Now, there's defense and there's defense. You cannot say that killing 30,000 people has been precision targeting. And if you have proper precision targeting, then yes, that is behaving properly within the rules of law. But I think the death of these aid workers shows that that is not working.
I have to put to you that the IDF would say that of those 30,000, and it's a tragedy that people have died, many of them were Hamas terrorists, is what the IDF would say to you, Sir Alan.
Yes, well, many of them probably were, but not 30,000. And how do they know? And when you bomb a hospital, you say, oh, it's full of terrorists. Well, I'm afraid, you know, the fact is you cannot just pile into a strip of land with 2 million people in it, which has been basically imprisoned for decades, and somehow say that, oh, it's all their fault when they fight back. So what we now have in Gaza is imposed famine. That is not following the rules that you've just questioned me about. Imposed to the point where we, as Brits, have to build a pontoon to try and take food into Gaza for a starvation famine which has been caused by the Israelis. And, you know, try to count to 30,000. Try just to count to the number of people who are kids with no parents, no families, no limbs. Then I think you will realise what's going on in Gaza.
A Conservative Party spokesperson confirmed that Duncan is now undergoing a disciplinary process as a result of those comments. Duncan is one of the few Tories who have publicly backed an end to the UK continuing arms sales to Israel. That small group just got a boost, however, because Tory peer Nicholas Soames, the grandson of Winston Churchill, said he believed it was time to cease arms exports to Israel. The Guardian reports Soames saying this. It's probably time that that happened now, yes. I think if we're determined to show that we are not prepared to countenance these ongoing disasters, Israel has every right to go after Hamas, there's no shadow of a doubt about that. But the UK's contribution to Israel's arsenal would be tiny, it's probably parts more than anything else. He also said this. What happened with the deaths of 7 aid workers was an absolute tragedy, and secondly, it was absolutely inexcusable. This is not a fog of war issue. The whole thing had been deconflicted, organised, everything, and something has gone very, very wrong, and the Israelis really need to get a grip of all of this. Secondly, these people were doing the most wonderful work to provide aid to starving Palestinians. I think it is the message that matters. Soames, as you could probably tell from that, is hardly a pro-Palestine voice, but he has rebelled against the Tory party before. In 2019, he voted to block a no-deal Brexit. Helena, if Alan Duncan is under investigation, surely Suella Braverman should be too for going completely off-piste.
I mean, at the end of the day, you have to scrutinise whose interests are fundamentally being served by each of these positions. And of course, Suella Braverman is pro-Israel, so she gets away with whatever she wants to do. And Alan Duncan is pro-Palestine, so he gets subjected to the same kind of McCarthyism that people in the Labour Party have been subjected to for very kind of similar statements about people who are serving other people's interests. I find it quite interesting as well, specifically in the statements that were made there by Duncan, he called out Conservative Friends of Israel. Now, there's a really great Peter Obon article in the Independent today. I highly recommend everybody going and reading, which talks about the influence of Conservative Friends of Israel in how they've changed in which the Conservative Party has functioned internally. Specifically, this is referring to Alan Duncan again. Of course, there's the Shai Masat moment that you mentioned earlier on in this segment. But in 2011, he had an actual run-in with Conservative Friends of Israel itself, when he was in a video when he was a junior minister in the Department for International Development, talking about specifically saying that that the Israelis were engaging in a land grab within the occupied territories, which is, of course, 100% true. You literally cannot argue against that 100%, because even if you just take the 1967 borders, which is the internationally recognized ones, as being like the statement at which you say, well, anything past there is a land grab, then we know, of course, they have. The illegal settlements are land grabs. That is not up for debate. Conservative Friends of Israel, specifically in their own statements, went to the highest echelons of government to try and get this removed. Now, that's just, and Peter Obon's words were saying, well, that's just kind of a euphemism for Downing Street, essentially, with David Cameron as prime minister. Again, somebody who had made, you know, comments about the Israel-Gaza conflict that I think would be laudable, like calling Gaza an open-air prison, which is true, was then the one who, again, we can only assume from this information that then led to that video from the DFID website getting taken down because it was critical of Israel's illegal actions in the West Bank. And that was Alan Duncan, who was at the mercy of CFI at that point. In that same article, Peter Obon also talks about how CFI went to the leadership of the Conservative Party when, during the Lebanon War in 2006, again, a resigning matter for Tony Blair, where William Hague specifically referred to the Israelis' actions as being disproportionate. And turns out those comments were then being removed. And now, of course, have you ever heard anybody call Israel's actions disproportionate since? No, of course you haven't. So there is also plenty of people who have influence within the Conservative Party in being able to change people's positions. And when we see it, we see the McCarthyism that comes down. And Alan Duncan is now a victim of this kind of action against him because of his pro-Palestine voice for the third time. Of course, I can't tell you whether CFI are necessarily involved in this specific instance. But of course, you know, he is the one who we can see is being removed, is being investigated. And again, only through double standards, because of course, when anybody makes kind of similar statements which undermine the government's position, as Suella Braverman has done, as you recognised in your original question, does she get investigated? Of course she doesn't. Of course she can get away with anything. But as soon as somebody in that same statement is being pro-Palestine, they are immediately investigated. And we see the same in the Labour Party as well. And so we really do have to call out the level to which the lobbyists have been central to Alan Duncan's internal play against the Conservative Party thus far. Very, very, very dark.
Yeah, and it is interesting, isn't it? The fact that we haven't seen many of these investigations launched into Tory party members, whether the membership or MPs, is because no one has really stuck their head over the parapet to the same degree that Labour Party members have thus far. But now we've seen Alan Duncan do this, and there's been immediate repercussions for him speaking out. Nevertheless, very refreshing to hear someone actually say it. Thank you, Helena, so much for joining me tonight.
It is always a pleasure joining you on Navarra Live, Moya. Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.